whole separate world, the cardiovascular problems. What we've seen instead is they interact. Here's two ways in which it could occur, just as examples. One we've heard already, have the metabolic end of problems in metabolic syndrome, have those problems of insulin resistance, and you're not storing away your glucose, and thus you are getting into trouble. The circulating glucose, the circulating fats you're not storing, what we've heard already is they are now more likely to get stuck onto those points of vascular damage of inflammation. Not a good thing. So there we see one intersection. Another way in which they can intersect, and this represents a fascinating shift in this field, which is an utterly bizarre thing. What do your fat cells do? What does your fat do? They store fat. They get fatty. They get plump and jolly. They store away nutrients. That's what your fat cells do. It's turning out fat cells can do something else. They can generate signals of inflammation in your body. Utterly bizarre thing. In fat cells, you generate some immune inflammatory activators that are supposed to be coming out of white blood cells in your immune system. Fat turns out to be an endocrine gland of releasing hormones, signaling molecules related to inflammation. So you can begin to guess here what our second scenario here is of an interaction between metabolic problems and cardiovascular problems. You've got a little bit of damage to your blood vessels thanks to that high blood pressure. And what's the next step that can go wrong? You begin to get inflammatory cells glomming on there to the injury site. If you've got a lot of fat stored away, what's going to happen? You are having a higher sort of basal level of inflammation in your body. You are increasing the odds of inflammation glomming on to that area of damaged blood vessels. We've got a metabolic problem, increasing your risk of a cardiovascular problem. So that's what metabolic syndrome is all about. It's this whole business that you can't put parts of your body into completely separate categories. And this is a theme that should be coming through over and over. This is a theme that came through in the first lecture. Remember, homeostasis, ideal body temperature, ideal everything. And the fact that towards the end of the first lecture, I noted that there's a new fancy term going around for modern state-of-the-art notions about homeostasis, this new term allostasis, which is getting a whole lot of attention these days. And I mentioned the example there, which is, suppose you're getting dehydrated, boring old local homeostatic type solution, your kidneys retain more water. Is what we saw was the more far-flung, fancy, realistic version, the allostatic version of it is, instead, yes, your kidneys retain more water, but you begin to sweat less, you have a sense of thirst coming out of your brain. You solve local challenges to balance, homeostatic balance, with all sorts of adaptations far-flung throughout your body. That's the allostatic notion. And where does that come in here? The very simple fact that you don't get challenges to only one small part of your body. They all interact. You get a small challenge going on in your levels of fat storage, and suddenly you're setting yourself up for cardiovascular disease. What the allostatic concept is all about is you can't break the body down into separate parts, which makes perfect sense, but it's hard to remember that. And one of the realms in which it's hard to remember that is you've got some problem or other and you go to your physician who orders up a blood panel, and out the other end you get this array of blood test results. And a lot of us sort of, you've seen those things, you get this long list of the various things that were measured, and then you have a normative range, what the average level is and what's the levels that are considered normal, below the average, above the average, and you get a whole bunch of little X's on your printout there saying what your own levels are compared to the normal range, and get them outside the range, below, above, and something counts as a problem because you have abnormal levels of whatever it is, blood glucose, hemoglobin, hematocrit, whatever it is, and thus your doctor picks it up by scanning down that chart with all the results there and seeing if there's any of these little X's outside the normal range. You got one that's on this side of the norm, but within that range, and the doctor says, well, you know, it's a little bit less of the stuff than we would like, it's a little bit more of the stuff than we would like, but it's still in the normal range. what the allostatic notion, what the metabolic syndrome notion, what the whole notion that you have intersections so that it makes no sense to break the body into cardiovascular, metabolic, and all these little buckets, what all of those collectively say is, even though all of those measures in your bloodstream may be normal, it may be abnormal to have so many of them almost abnormal. A whole collectivity of things going wrong, this theme that nothing in your body is a separate little domain. So as we've gone over our basic theme now here, short-term stress response, good news, long-term chronic, we've seen a first theme in the last few lectures, one that's going to run through all of them. They're not separate areas. A problem in one domain, you're going to pay a price in the other, metabolic dysfunction, cardiovascular, as we'll see, calling these lectures about this particular subject, this particular organ system, is just as a convenient way of dealing with them. They don't separate.
Lecture 5, stress, overeating, and your digestive tract.
This is Robert Sapolsky reporting live from the 87th Annual Rose Bowl Parade, and it is a beautiful day in Pasadena. It is clear and sunny. The crowds are large and enthusiastic, and at a time like this, one must think about irritable bowel syndrome. What did we do in the last lecture? What did we do? We thought about what happens to nutrients once it's digested, hits your bloodstream, the whole world of storing energy, mobilizing it, all of that that we went through before. In this lecture, what we focus on is the gastrointestinal tract. Once the food gets into your mouth, and then your esophagus, and your stomach, and your intestines, what does stress have to do with that realm? And starting with your mouth, of course, the very first issue is, how desirous are you of putting food in your mouth? What does stress do to appetite? Now, we all know what stress does to appetite, which it does something or other to appetite. Now, if you talk to people and you say, well, when you're stressed, do you eat more than usual? About two-thirds of people will say yes. When you're stressed, do you eat less than usual? About a third of people say yes as well. And what do we suddenly have? We have the shocking finding, officially, that stress changes appetite. This doesn't do us any good at all. What is actually going on? What's happening that influences why two-thirds of people or so become stress hyperphagic? They eat more. The others tend to eat less. What's happening with that? Now, a piece of what's occurring is psychological component to this, where it turns out those two-thirds of people have something in common, which is on a regular basis, when they are eating a meal, they are consciously regulating the amount of food they take in. They're watching their diet. They're making sure they eat something healthy. They are passing on some dessert that is tempting. And along comes stress. And what happens is you say, this is an incredibly stressful period. Enough of that self-regulation. I am going to gorge. It's like if all you do is watch on television some like pensive, introspective British period piece play when secretly you would love to be watching professional wrestling, along comes some horrible, stressful period, and you say, screw this with the English drama. I'm going to watch professional wrestling and then watch some roller derby. What you do during stress is you tend to suspend some of the regulatory processes you have going on, some of that self-discipline stuff. I'm stressed. I'm going to eat more. So two-thirds of people, on the average, have that sort of psychological makeup. But there's an additional reason why most people wind up eating more food when they're under stress. And this has to do with an incredibly complicated piece of endocrinology, which will make perfect sense when you think about it. Back to our basic endocrinology, those axes having to do with the brain as the master gland. So we've already heard about glucocorticoids, those key stress hormones that come out of the adrenal. You already know all about them, what they do. And as promised, your adrenals don't know what they're doing. Your brain, with the onset of stress, secretes a particular hypothalamic hormone, which causes the pituitary to secrete a hormone, which stimulates the adrenals to release glucocorticoids. So there's something with the dynamics of this which is very, very critical. So you secrete that hypothalamic hormone within a second or two of the onset of stress. If you deeply care about such minutiae, this hormone is called corticotropin-releasing hormone. Do not write that down. The hypothalamic stress hormone. So with the onset of stress, your hypothalamus releases that stress hormone within seconds. And obviously, it's going to take a longer time to start secreting glucocorticoids because the hypothalamic stress hormone has to do something at your pituitary, which then drools out its stuff. So the very earliest phase of the stress response is dominated exclusively by that hypothalamic stress hormone. Once glucocorticoids levels kick up with the stressor going on for a while, the profile is elevated levels of both the hypothalamic stress hormone and glucocorticoids. End of stress. Your hypothalamus takes like 2.5 seconds to shut off its secretion of that hypothalamic hormone, and it takes quite a few minutes for glucocorticoid levels to go back to normal. In other words, hypothalamic hormone up by itself, first couple of seconds of stress, both hypothalamic hormone and glucocorticoids up, you're in the middle of a stressor, only glucocorticoids up, and it's over with. What we introduce now, for the first time since the elephants, is the importance of the recovery stage. So what's the stress response stage about? We already know what it's about in terms of energy. You're mobilizing energy and sending it to your exercising muscle. So that's all over with, and what you now need to do is store that energy back where it came from. How do you do this? We heard from the last lecture that whole song and dance about insulin, but something else happens. Your appetite increases so that you replace all that energy you depleted running for your life. So what does that? We already heard that glucocorticoids, when they're elevated during a stress response, when those hypothalamic hormone levels are up also, they're involved in mobilizing energy. Once you get to that phase where all you've got are the elevated glucocorticoid levels, that recovery phase, what glucocorticoids do is they stimulate appetite. They stimulate this recovery process. And again, this is the first time we are seeing the critical role of one of these stress hormones, not in mediating the stress response, but mediating the recovery from. So now we've got something critical that I've already told you. The end of stress, and it takes just a couple of seconds for those hypothalamic stress hormones to go back to normal. End of stress, it takes quite a few minutes for glucocorticoid levels to go back to normal. In other words, after any given stressor, there's a period afterward of increased appetite. So now let's think about chronic stress. You got someone who says, oh my God, I'm so stressed, I get stuck in traffic every day, and I have a horrible boss, and my relationship is unsteady, and all of these sorts of things, and I am like totally stressed nonstop 24/7. This is not like totally stressed nonstop 24/7. You want to know what totally stressed 24/7 is about? You look at somebody with a whole body burn. You look at somebody in septic shock. That's stressed 24/7. What we mean in an everyday sense when we say, oh my God, I'm just stressed all the time, what we actually mean is we turn on the stress response over and over repeatedly throughout the day. The car that almost doesn't start, and then the horrible traffic, and then the sneaking into work 10 minutes late without the boss seeing. And what we call everyday chronic stress is instead lots and lots of intermittent stressors. So what happens? What we just saw was for any given one of those intermittent stressors, typically the amount of time that you're turning on the stress response can be pretty brief, and the amount of time the stress response goes on is pretty brief. We're talking about these brief intermittent stressors, and the amount of time it takes to recover where your appetite is stimulated is longer. In other words, if you spend all day long having these bursts of intermittent stressors, you are spending a lot of all day long recovering from them with your appetite increased, and suddenly you have chronic stress increasing appetite. So that is definitely not a good thing. We begin to see here why most of us eat more during periods of stress and why those nutrients tend to get stored away. Now, the next piece of trouble we get into has to do with not just the fact that we eat more during stress, but we eat more of certain things. And this one we all know about. You do not get wildly stressed and decide now's the time to switch over to a spinach diet. You get stressed, and like most of us, what you do is you crave carbs, you crave carbohydrates, bread, sugars, treats, candy, all of that. You get a carbohydrate craving. So what is this about? This is certainly not a clever thing. The least you can do is, if you're overeating because of chronic stress, is eat healthy stuff. And instead, we all tend to get this carbohydrate craving. And remarkably, this does you some good. Remarkably, you increase those blood sugar levels. Remember back by now, we know dietary carbs get broken down into simple sugars, and they fuel your muscles and all that stuff we know about. One of the other things they do is they lower glucocorticoid levels. In other words, when you were stressed, eating carbs is anti-stress. This is not just gibberish about, oh, I'm going to feel much better if I scarf down 8 Hershey bars during this period. Increasing carbs in your diet during acute stressors help turn off glucocorticoid secretion. And that's perfect, because your glucocorticoid levels go back to normal that much faster. That's great. That's adaptive during the recovery. This is amazing. So, with chronic stress, not only do you eat more, you get this craving for carbohydrates. And in some wonderful work done by Mary Dahlman, University of California, San Francisco, has worked out precisely how this works. Which part of your hypothalamus is measuring the glucose in your bloodstream? Which parts are sensitive to fatty acids? Which take information about what's in your bloodstream and then affect your diet? And then affect your appetite, and then affect your glucocorticoid secretion. So we've got this big regulatory loop here, which winds up having this important implication. Not only do you start eating more during chronic stress, during frequent intermittent stressors, not only do most of us do that, but the craving we get is for the worst possible kind of food at that time. So bad news. Let's have even more bad news. What we now consider is where those excess calories go. We know where all those excess calories go. They go into your fat cells. But here we have an extremely important feature of fat physiology, the fact that all fat cells are not the same. The fact that it depends on where in your body the fat is being stored. And here we come to the great dichotomy between two different types of fat, fat that winds up in your belly, abdominal fat, and fat that winds up in your rear end, gluteal fat, abdominal fat versus gluteal or truncal fat. And you have this very simple deal here, which is one of them is a lot worse than the other. One of them gets you into a lot more trouble. What you have is a different body shape, a different body morphometry, a different body shape depending on whether you are putting on abdominal fat or gluteal. And the jargon used in the field is when you put on abdominal fat, you look like an apple. Whereas if you put on gluteal fat, you look like a pear. And being overweight, having excess fat at extremes, one could take on an apple profile or a pear profile. And the official deal is the apple version of it is the one that's not good for you. The apple version is the one that gets you into trouble, the abdominal fat. Now, why should this be? For a whole bunch of reasons. First off, very first one, abdominal fat is, as you heard, like any sort of fat, releasing all sorts of inflammatory signals and some of the most vulnerable blood vessels in your body to those inflammatory messages happen to be more in your torso here. So that's not good. Next thing, abdominal fat is sitting real close to your liver, and that could produce the dread state of a fatty liver, not a good thing. So that's bad. Another thing that winds up being bad, which is sheer mechanical pressure, abdominal fat is pulling your spine forward, gluteal is like increasing, lowering your center of gravity, abdominal fat puts more stress on your body. Now we begin to see one of those awful facts that explains all sorts of disturbing things about the universe. You remember back to insulin. How does insulin work? Insulin goes floating around in the bloodstream and binds to an insulin receptor. And as I noted, that's the same thing with all of these hormones out there, and glucocorticoids do their thing by binding to glucocorticoid receptors. So now we have a key thing, which is some parts of the body have more glucocorticoid receptors than other parts, and it turns out fat cells have lots of glucocorticoid receptors. Abdominal fat cells are the ones with the most. So in other words, along comes a stressful period, and in the aftermath, you are set up for increased appetite. You are set up for that increased appetite taking the form of the worst possible food you can be eating. And on top of it all now, with chronic stress, you are set up to store that excess fat in exactly the part of the body where you don't want to be doing it, in the abdominal fat stores. So, not a good thing. It turns out that individual differences come in here. And this was something promised at the end of the second lecture. All of this physiology, all of this complexity works different in one person than another. And this helps to begin to explain why some people are more prone towards putting on weight with chronic stress. It could be because they get more of a food craving. Perhaps they secrete more glucocorticoids. It could be because that carbohydrate business is even more effective at turning off secretion. All these different possible domains of how things work differently in one person than another. It could also be because you happen to have more glucocorticoid receptors in your abdominal fat. Or another version could be, at the end of stress, as I said, it takes a few minutes for glucocorticoid levels to go back down to normal. Maybe you just happen to be the sort of person where it takes a lot longer than average to levels go back to normal. So for every one of those intermittent stressors, you are soaking your system in more glucocorticoids during the recovery period than most people do. More of the craving, more of this craving for the carbohydrates, more of the storing it away in all the bad places. Possible realm of individual differences. And some really nice work by Alyssa Eppel, again of the University of California, San Francisco, focusing in on those individual differences, looking at people who are really prone towards abdominal fat deposition. And one of the explanations is some of these are folks who are very slow in having their glucocorticoid system recover back to normal after a stressor. What's also running through as a theme in here? So we've got excessive eating, and long ago we had sort of the four horsemen of the apocalypse and sloth and greed and also, and we have modern versions, which is eating to excess and smoking and drinking too much and not exercising. And in lots of ways, there's sort of a moral thread that runs through the issue of proper weight, which is being overweight represents some sort of loss of discipline. Yes, indeed, in some cases. But we're also seeing how much of this stuff has to do with just the nuts and bolts of what sort of biological deck of cards you've wound up with. And we all differ as to how many glucocorticoid receptors and how jumpy our adrenal is and how much the part of the brain that is sensitive to the carbohydrates' wonderfully calming influences, how sensitive it is to it, we begin to see all these individual differences coming in. So we've gotten this array of ways in which things can go wrong. Your appetite increases for the worst possible stuff. You tend to deposit as the worst kind of fat, and lots of individual differences come in there. So this is the world of apples versus pears. Mind you, you go to the doctor, and almost certainly the physician is not going to say, uh-oh, you're getting a little more apple-ish than last time. The formal way in which this is measured is the waist girth, how far around your belly, how far around your hips, your waist-to-hip ratio. In other words, how much of the abdominal fat you have versus how much of the gluteal. That's the formal way in which it's measured. You don't get an apple-ish number, but it's tapping into that exact same concept. Okay, now what's going on in your gut? We've seen a ton here about appetite. How about your gastrointestinal tract? And with chronic stress, all sorts of things can go wrong. The general logic here is obvious, we know already, which is acute stressor, run for your life, you've got better things to do than digestion, turn off the digestive tract, we know this scenario in our sleep now. Chronic stress, if you chronically shut down the gastrointestinal system, somehow disease risk is going to pop out the other end. Where does the disease risk come from? How do we normally turn off our bowels during stress? Very simple. You've heard this already. Onset of stress, turn off the parasympathetic nervous system, turn on the sympathetic, and that winds up sending a signal, decrease contractions in your stomach. Decrease contractions in your small intestines, decrease salivary secretion, that whole pathway we know about. Shut down your gastrointestinal system. You got better things to do right now, etc. One exception, though. One interesting exception, which provides a remarkable parallel to something we heard a couple of lectures back. You are profoundly, utterly, traumatically stressed. And one of the things that tends to happen with people is, in moments of crisis like that, they lose control over their bladder. In the same way, sometimes you lose control over your bowels. What's that about? Same exact sort of story, same severity as with the bladder business. Again, in lots of states, people, when they are executed, have diapers put on them. And that's that same logic again, which is people often lose control over both their bladder and their bowels. What's happening here is this very interesting dichotomy. Onset of stress, sympathetic nervous system sending a signal, stop the stomach contractions, stop the intestinal contractions, increase the contractions of your large intestines, your colon, small intestines, less activation, large intestines, more constriction. This makes great sense. Small intestines are like your kidney. You're absorbing stuff out of it, nutrients, all sorts of regulatory steps. Large intestines, once stuff hits there, there's like no nutritional content to it. This is just stuff heading out for recycling. This is stuff that's going to get dumped. All you do with your umpteen feet of large intestines is reabsorb some water so you don't desiccate like a prune going to the bathroom. Not very interesting. Not essential. So we've got that same choice again. As you run for your life from the lion, you could do it with or without 5 pounds of dead weight down there in your large intestines. Same logic again. Void your bowels as you are voiding your bladder. With the onset of major stressors, you increase contractions in your large intestines, pushing stuff out faster. So that's great. That's exactly why you want to be soiling yourself as you're running away from the lion. What about in the face of chronic stress? And what we get into here now is an extremely confusing domain of gastrointestinal disorders. They come in two flavors. You have either an organic bowel disorder or a functional bowel disorder. This is a very fancy way of saying you have bowel disorders where people know what the disease is versus ones where nobody has a clue. Organic bowel disorders, there is an explanation. There's an abnormality in the structure of the absorptive whatever's in your small intestines. You've got your lactase not doing right stuff. They know what's going on. Functional bowel disorders is what they diagnose you with when they haven't a clue what's up and they got to give you some sort of name because they're going to charge you out the wazoo on the other end of this. Functional bowel disorders are ones that are exquisitely sensitive to stress. And this is the realm of things like irritable bowel syndrome or spastic colon. This is the realm in which emotions, by way of the autonomic nervous system, by way of stress hormones, can greatly regulate all that stuff with your bowels. So what's going on with things like spastic colon, with stress-induced bowel abnormalities. Remember what we had a few minutes ago, this amazing, beautiful choreography with the onset of stress. Ideally, you want to decrease contraction in the small intestine and increase them in large. End of stress, you want to reverse the process. Here comes another stressor, you do it again, and have chronic enough of stress, and the choreography, the timing gets out of whack. And suddenly, you got things contracting when they shouldn't, and you've got the run. Suddenly, things are not contracting when they should. You got an opposite problem. It's a problem of simply coordinating this fairly subtle adaptation. Get chronically stressed, and things simply don't work very well down there. And this is remarkably common. Just to inject the sort of autobiographical note that I know all of you want to sort of hear about in courses like this, every major juncture in my life has been filled with the runs a few days before. My bar mitzvah, going off to college, defending my thesis in preparation of proposing to someone, my wife on my wedding day, all of that. In all of those cases, all sorts of uncoordinated things were clearly going on with my small and large intestines. There, wasn't that personal note pleasing? So, you've got these disorders. You've got these disorders of stress messing up the coordination in these different parts of your gastrointestinal system. There's two ways that can happen. One is, if you're sending too much of a stress signal, turn off, turn on, go the other way, all of that. The other is, if your bowels happen to be overly sensitive to normal stress signals. And what is becoming clear is some folks with irritable bowel syndrome, the problem is not chronic activation of the stress response. The problem is hypersensitivity to normal stress signals. How can you show this? And this is the sort of science that's done that's really wonderful. You take a bunch of people, and some of them have spastic colon, irritable bowel syndrome, and some of them don't. You've got your two groups, and you give them an experimental stressor. They have to sit there for 10 minutes with their hand in a bucket of ice. They have to do some time-pressured math tests. They have to give some sort of public speech when that disturbs them greatly. They have some sort of stressor, and you look at how much their large intestines increase contracting. The folks with the irritable bowel syndrome problems, for the same stressor, they increase the contractions more. So one version of the problem is hypersensitivity to a stress signal. The other version is another group of people with these functional bowel disorders. They have elevated levels of stress hormones. Their sympathetic nervous system is overactive, things of that sort. So we see all sorts of ways in which that can go wrong. Final domain. Being classicists here, we have to return to the stress-related disease that started the entire field, ulcers. Ulcers back to Hans Selye and his stressed rats in the 1930s, back to that very first sign, chronic stress, you get an ulcer. Everybody knows this. Chronic stress. Stress and ulcers completely intertwined. The stress-related disease. But then, about 20 years ago, there was this revolution in ulcerology. These two Australian scientists discovered, actually, ulcers are caused by a bacteria called Helicobacter pylorus. What happens, people who have ulcers, like 90% of the cases in the West, what they have is a Helicobacter infection in their stomach. What does this bacteria do? It generates these things called oxygen radicals, and it blows holes in the wall of your stomach. It's a bacterial disorder. This was a major, major discovery. This got these guys the Nobel Prize. This was an enormously important finding because suddenly it says that ulcers arise from a bacterial disorder. They're organic in nature. They are not psychogenic. There's nothing to do with this stress stuff. This was the greatest news among gastroenterologists. The day everybody suddenly learned about Helicobacter, like every gastroenterologist on earth went out and celebrated that evening, never again were they going to have to sit down with their patients and make eye contact and ask them, how's it going? So anything stressful in your life? It's got nothing to do with stress. It's a bacterial disorder. Give them their antibiotics next. Suddenly, stress has nothing to do with ulcers. Stress has everything to do with ulcers for a very simple reason. Only about 10% of the people with Helicobacter infections get an ulcer. It's not enough to merely have the bacterial infection. You got to have something else. You got to have the bacterial load, and you've got to have some sort of lifestyle risk factor. And in their overlap comes the highly increased risk of ulcers. Where do the lifestyle risk factors come in? That's the stress. That's the stress component to ulceration. There's one domain of ulcers that's completely due to stress. They're called stress ulcers, and those emerge over the course of a couple of days, and they're life-threatening. These are whole-body burn-induced ulcers. But back in the normal range of ulcers, these Helicobacter-driven ones, only 1 out of 10 people with the bacteria get the ulcers. It's the intersection between the bacterial load and the stress. Where does that come in? And here we see one of our great lessons from this course. The stress response, those glucocorticoids, those other stress hormones, they're not causing ulcers. They're not generating this disease. What are they doing instead? Back to the very first lecture. You're running for your life and digest some other time. Don't bother with digestion. Stop the stomach contractions. You're running for your life and divert your blood to where it's really needed, your muscles. You're running for your life and don't repair anything going wrong in your stomach walls because it's an emergency. Do it later, do it later. And if you were chronically stressed, what happens is all the time you got the starts of little ulcers here and there if you had Helicobacter, and normally you're pretty good at repairing it. Instead, because you were chronically stressed, over and over your body is saying, do it later, do it later. Stress does not cause ulcers. Stress impairs your defenses, your ability to repair ulcers in their earliest stage. And what we have here is a central concept in this course, which is the overlap between the organic basis of disease and the psychogenic basis. And what you see very importantly here is if all you do is concentrate on one piece of the story, you're not going to know what's going on. It's the intersection that is critical and informative.
Lecture 6, Stress and Growth, Echoes from the Womb.
Now, all of us are different sorts of people. We have different tastes, we have different habits, we have different values. Nonetheless, all of us have one thing in common, which is we grew up at some point. We went through fetal development. We went through child development. And what the next two lectures are about is, what does stress have to do with child development? Okay, you already know the punchline in your sleep. You're running for your life. You're a young individual running for your life. You're a kid. And your body has better things to do under those circumstances than deposit calcium in your long bones, grow later if there is a later. Short-term stress response, highly adaptive. Chronic stress response, you impair growth. That's the concept that will run through the next two lectures. Chronic stress, environmental stressors, can disrupt the normal growth process. Now, the point of this lecture is one critical fact, which is environment doesn't begin at birth. Environment begins in fetal life. And thus, the consequences of stress can begin in fetal life also. Now, what's environment like for a fetus? What's stress like for a fetus? Well, what it's about is what mom is experiencing. Because you share something absolutely critical with your mother when you're a fetus. You share her circulatory system. And the hormones in her bloodstream will wind up to some extent in your own circulatory system. The amount of nutrients will become relevant in there. You have all sorts of ways in which maternal experience is translated into fetal experience. Even something as straightforward as extremely loud noises, fetuses can respond to. It turns out amniotic fluid is this great vibratory resonating environment. What's going on in the outside world can affect a fetus. And what we have is the simple punchline here is, well, you don't want to be a stressed fetus. You don't want to have the same sort of stressors that follow the same logic built around grow tomorrow, grow tomorrow. Now, what this begins to bring in are two realms of consequences of fetal stress. The first is what you're like at birth, and in the simplest sort of level, more fetal stress equals a lower body weight at birth, what sort of individual you're like at birth. And the other, a much more subtle point, is fetal experience, fetal stress, influencing what sort of adult body you're going to have responding to adult environments. Now, the second subtle point, the notion of fetal experience translating into how your body works as an adult, brings in all sorts of new concepts, one of which can be summarized with terms that are absolutely metaphors, the fact that a fetus makes decisions about what sort of organism to grow into, that a fetus is programmed by experience, by environment. These are metaphorical terms. Things get set down. Things get regulated in a permanent sort of way during fetal life. What do I mean by this? Let me give a first example, and this is an absolutely extraordinary one. I mean, we are all used to this typical sequence of scientific knowledge. In this realm, you study something in laboratory animals, you see how it works, you understand its world, and then you see if it works in humans. This is a case where it started with humans. And this is a phenomenon known as the Dutch hunger winter. 1944, World War II, Holland is occupied by the Nazis, and for a number of reasons, the uprising of resistance among the Dutch against the Nazis, the decision was made to punish Holland and divert all of the food that winter to Germany. And suddenly, Holland, with its reasonably good westernized diet, plunged into famine. Over the course of that famine, something like 16,000 people starved to death. Absolute disaster. And something very interesting came out of it. Suppose you were a fetus, a second or third trimester fetus during the Dutch hunger winter. What's going on? You are experiencing that starvation insofar as there's less nutrients in mom's bloodstream. You were experiencing this environmental stressor. So it turns out that one of the things that a fetus decides, one of the things in which a fetus is programmed to respond to, one of the things going on there is the fetus, in effect, is deciding, well, how much food is there out there in that world I'm heading into soon? And be a fetus at that time during starvation, and what your body concludes is there's not a whole lot out there. And thus your body gets programmed to be thrifty. What do we mean by thrifty? Every bit of food that hits your bloodstream, quick, store it away. Translated into a few lectures ago, every bit of nutrients that hit your bloodstream secrete insulin like crazy. Every bit of salt that you have, kidneys really good at retaining it because who knows when the next salt is coming. Be really thrifty at storing stuff. So, Dutch hunger winter ends, and suddenly you're going back to a normal, healthy Dutch diet, and everything else being equal, 50 years later, you are now close to 20 times more likely to have metabolic syndrome. Because your body learned as a fetus to be really efficient, really thrifty, really good at storing away nutrients, and you've programmed your metabolic system to work that way forever after. Mind you, if you were a newborn during the Dutch hunger winter, if you were first trimester fetus, it didn't work that way. You don't see this Dutch hunger phenomenon. It happens second and third trimester is when a fetus is programming its response to nutrients, how tripwire of insulin secretion it has. It's during that time that you are programming your adult metabolism. So there we see a really disturbing, remarkable phenomenon. And this turns out to be one of a number of examples of this, number of examples that have been summed by epidemiologists named David Barker as fetal origins of adult disease, FOAD, this completely new area of research built around the notion that environment doesn't begin at birth, and an awful lot of what's going on in fetal life causes programming of how adult responses are going to be. Remarkable. And soon people were studying this in laboratory animals, seeing experimental versions of prenatal stress, and you see the exact same thing. You can generate a Dutch hunger winter phenomenon. You can show that prenatal stress, and as an adult, you have a less than optimal stress response. You have elevated levels of glucocorticoids basally when there's no stressor. In the absence of stress, prenatally stressed rats as adults secrete more glucocorticoids than they're supposed to. Bad news. Prenatally stressed rats as adults take a longer time to recover after the end of a stressor for their glucocorticoid levels to go back to normal. Prenatally stressed rats as adults are more vulnerable to metabolic syndrome. All sorts of things, even the domain of behavior, anxiety. There's this chemical your brain makes, which is called an endogenous benzodiazepine. Don't panic. The synthetic, the drug version of it is something like Valium or Librium, anti-anxiety drugs. And just like all the other examples we've heard, the benzodiazepines that your brain makes interact with benzodiazepine receptors to decrease anxiety. A prenatally stressed rat as an adult has fewer of those benzodiazepine receptors in its brain, more of a predisposition than towards anxiety. Even in the realm of learning, prenatal stress and something about those elevated glucocorticoid levels disrupt aspects of brain development, aspects relevant to learning and memory. Prenatally stressed rats, everything else being equal from birth on, have more memory problems, aren't quite as good at learning, at consolidating new things, in part because they have elevated glucocorticoid levels as an adult, beginning to disrupt cognition. Stay tuned, that's going to be an entire lecture. But also because of that prenatal environment disrupting brain development. So look at this. We've got this whole world of prenatal stress, which could influence your levels of stress hormones as an adult, how readily you recover from a stress response, your brain chemistry that deals with anxiety, learning, vulnerability to metabolic disease. Again, that critical punchline, which is environment doesn't begin at birth. So there's an even more interesting ripple to this. And what it winds up doing is having Dutch hunger winter effects that are in fact multi-generational. Here's what I mean. You were a Dutch hunger fetus, Dutch hunger winter fetus, and 30 years later, you are now pregnant. You are having a child. Thanks to that fetal experience, you have a thrifty metabolism. You secrete insulin like crazy, so you're really good at stealing nutrients from your circulation. You retain salt, all that sort of stuff. So you are having a perfectly typical diet during your pregnancy, but as I just said, you are stealing an atypically large amount of it from your fetus. You are more efficient at taking nutrients out of the bloodstream, so for that perfectly normal diet, your fetus is getting less nutrients than it should. Certainly not starving, but insofar as you're absorbing more of it than normal, your fetus is getting less of it than normal. In other words, Dutch hunger winter babies, when they become pregnant, generate Dutch hunger winter babies. It's multi-generational. This has now been shown in the Dutch hunger winter humans. Their grandkids show some of these same tendencies. It's been shown in laboratory rats as well. This is multi-generational. Mind you, it's not as big of a phenomenon. It's one where it's a ripple of prenatal effect that with each generation gets smaller and smaller. But nonetheless, this is remarkable. Fetal life can leave an imprint, can leave an echo, can leave scar tissue of disease risk multi-generationally. Now, this is real critical in lots of ways because you look at this and you say, wow, this could easily be mistaken for something else. In other words, you take a rat who has been made a Dutch hunger winter rat as a result of fetal malnutrition. And as an adult, is much better at storing calories. And as an adult, when she's pregnant, gives birth to babies who are a little bit prone towards this Dutch hunger winter phenomenon. You do a laboratory experiment, which is as soon as the babies are born, you take them away from the mom and they're raised by a different mother. It's called cross-fostering, a standard technique in these experimental studies. And you see a trait in these babies that were fostered elsewhere, a trait that they don't share with their adoptive mother, a trait that they share with their biological mother. As seen here, this propensity towards metabolic syndrome. And you look at that and you say, well, all they had in common was their shared genes, took them away right at birth. Oh, if they have this same tendency towards this metabolic disease as their biological mom, it must be genetic. Look, it's passed on over time. And what we see here is, again, that truism, which is environment doesn't begin at birth. If you're not careful, some of these prenatal programming effects might be mistaken for, in fact, being genetic. Okay, so now we take this and we transition to the next logical phase, which is moving from all this prenatal stress stuff into postnatal, the sort of stress you experience during childhood. And how does that work? What are the general consequences? You know already exactly what it's going to be. It's the same punchline. In a child, as opposed to a fetus, chronic activation of the stress response does all sorts of bad stuff. And it's in a very similar realm, very similar sorts of punchlines. If you stress an infant, rat, stress not by nutrient deprivation, so in this case, you're not producing a Dutch hunger winter effect, stress in all sorts of different possible ways, and you produce an adult rat with higher glucocorticoid levels, an adult rat who has trouble turning off glucocorticoid secretion at the end of stress, a rat with a somewhat activated stress response all the time when there's nothing stressful going on, a rat more vulnerable to a bunch of those diseases. You get a rat who is not as good at learning and memory, whose brain in the cognitive realm hasn't developed all that well. You get a rat that is more prone towards anxiety. You get a rat that has fewer of those benzodiazepine receptors in there. You have parts of the brain like the hippocampus, which does not develop as normally. Stay tuned, we'll hear plenty about that. You've got all sorts of these long-term consequences. The same sort of picture there. Now, what this begins to bring in is something even more subtle. First question that one might arise when grasping all these prenatal and postnatal stress effects is, well, how much do I have to worry about it in terms of, is this a Dutch hunger winter phenomenon? Everybody who has a fairly normal diet as a fetus, everything is fine, and it's only at the extreme that suddenly you get this increased metabolic risk. No, what you see instead is across the whole normal range of prenatal nutrition, across the whole range as manifested in birth weight as a percentage of body length, this is not just about the extremes. So once you recognize that it's not just about these extreme states, but instead the whole array of developmental stressors, moderate, medium, severe, all of that, the whole array of prenatal effects, suddenly you realize there's something that's got to come into the equation, which is mothering style. Different styles of mothering can represent and generate a more stimulatory environment, a less, a more stressful, all of that. And suddenly you've got this whole issue of, does mothering style have an influence on the nature of metabolic programming, what sort of stress response the offspring has an adult? And there's been some wonderful work done on this by lots of investigators. One of the leading ones, named Michael Meany at McGill University, fabulous scientist, and also an old friend and collaborator, who gave a very modern spin to a time-worn phenomenon in this field. Take a newborn rat, and over the first couple of weeks of its life, pick it up every day and handle it. Pet it for a few minutes, take it away from its mom for a few minutes, and then put it back. Do that every day for 3 minutes or so, and what you have now done is neonatally handled that rat. And what this counts as is stimulation. And remarkably, this is now a rat who, as an adult, will have lower glucocorticoid levels, that will have better learning and memory, as it turns out, will have a more neurologically intact old age, the right amount of stimulation. Meanwhile, do something else, pick up a rat and pet it and put it away from mom for 180 minutes, for 3 hours rather than 3 minutes, and then bring it back to mom, and you now produce an adult with a hyperactive stress response, an impaired cognition, and what you see is it's the exact same stimulus, maternal deprivation and tactile stimulation. 3 minutes, great thing. 3 hours, terrible thing. What we will come to in later lectures, where's the transition from stimulation to stress? So this very well-established phenomenon, this neonatal handling business. Now, when you stop and think about it, whatever's going on inside these baby rats did not evolve in order to give grad students doctorates out of petting rats 3 minutes a day. What's the equivalent in a rat's real world? And what Meany first showed was this translate into mothering style. You take the baby rats away from mom for a certain length of time, and you bring the rat back, and mom changes her behavior. And what you see is, when the baby's away for only 3 minutes, mom becomes more attentive. She grooms the baby more. She licks the baby more. Take the infant away for 3 hours, put him back with mom, and there's a certain degree of detachment that goes on then. Mothering style, what this handling phenomenon is mostly about, is what sort of maternal behaviors are elicited when you return the pup. Meany then took it one step further. Forget this, taking the pup out of the cage and petting it and taking it away from mom for differing lengths of time. Now, just do something much more straightforward, which is look at the style of mothering. What's the normative range of mothering among rats? Remarkably enough, some rats are more attentive moms than other rats. The normal range of variability applies to all sorts of other species. Absolutely straightforward. Some rats lick their pups more than other rats do. Some rats groom their babies more, some groom them less, some are more or less physically rough with them, more interactive, all those sorts of things you can imagine. And what they see in their studies is the extent to which there is maternal licking and grooming will cause programming in adulthood. Get a mom who does an optimal amount of licking and grooming of her baby rat there, and she produces an adult with lower glucocorticoid levels, better learning and memory, all that sort of stuff. So that's absolutely remarkable. And it turns out that there's all sorts of ways in which rat mothering style translates into a different adult stress response in the offspring. Turns out to work the same way in non-human primates. And that can take all sorts of forms. Very simple sort of one. How anxious of a monkey mother do you have? What does anxiety in a mothering style look like in a non-human primate? Baby gets up and goes walking to start exploring the world. How far away from mom can it go before mom reaches over and grabs her kid and yanks them back, saying, "The world's not a safe place when you get this far from me." And anxious monkey mothers, the kids go a tiny difference before mom communicates anxiety and, "Ooh, it's scary, come on back," and less anxious mothers even further away. And that translates into different stress hormone levels. That translates into different adult profiles of stress responses. Absolutely amazing. So we've now seen a couple of remarkable things here. One, environment doesn't begin at birth. These really long-term, persistent effects on physiology, on disease risk, as a function of fetal stress experience. And we've now seen very similar sorts of themes in postnatal experience while growing up. And what we see is this is not just about extremes. This covers the range of differences in stimulation and stress that's encompassed even in differences in mothering style among rats and monkeys. Now, what's become a huge question in the field, a huge challenge, and one which, you know, has to be in there the second you start thinking about stuff working this way, is how does it work this way? How do you translate how much a mother rat licks her pups into what sort of glucocorticoid levels those pups are going to have in their old age in some cases. How does that work? And that is an extraordinarily tough problem to try to make any headway with, because this is not obvious. How does licking turn into a different hypothalamus or perhaps pituitary adrenals? How did this stuff work? And this is where Meany and his collaborators have come up with some extraordinary findings. This whole new area of molecular biology, close your ears if this is more detail than you want, but this whole new field called epigenetics. You got genes which direct the construction of certain proteins, and when a gene activates, it generates a certain protein that it codes for. That's great. Genes as determining the workings of the entire universe. When does a gene know when to activate? And it turns out in your DNA,